stay, for one thing, whereas I wouldn't. I had come here with some sense of its being the end of the line, maybe in a positive way, but I found I had no claim on grace. Seeing it as home was a hopeful construction, fake, like the terrarium. I'd deal with Doc Homer insofar as that was possible in 1 year, and then I'd rejoin Carlo or think about another research job. I had no specifics in mind. My future was mapped in negatives. Next year, I could be anywhere but here. I told Hallie about my bold, ridiculous little deposition on the pH of the river, and a few days later, I'd had to follow up with the news of the river's getting dammed, questions of pH being entirely academic. I felt humiliated. Eventually, she wrote back to say, "Think of how we grew up. You can't live through something like that and not take risks now. There's no getting around it." She was admonishing me, I guess. I should have more loyalty to my hometown. I wasn't brave. I was still trying to get around it. A good citizen of the nation in love with forgetting. I pelleted the surface of the water with goldfish flakes. In nature, there are animals that fight and those that flee. I was a flighty beast. Hallie seemed to think I'd crossed over. She claimed I was the one who'd once wanted to dig in and fight to save the coyote pups. Emelina thought I'd been ringleader in campaigns to save stewing hens. In my years of clear recall, there was no such picture. When Hallie and I lived in Tucson in the time of the refugees, she would stay up all night rubbing the backs of people's hands and holding their shell-shocked babies. I couldn't. I would cross my arms over my chest and go to bed. Later, after my second year of med school, I'd been able to address their external wounds, but no more than that. The people of Grace would soon be refugees, too, turned out from here like pennies from a pocket. Their history would dissolve as families made their separate ways to Tucson or Phoenix where there were jobs. I tried to imagine Emelina's bunch in a tract house, her neighbors all keeping a nervous eye on the color coordination of her flower beds, and my wonderfully overconfident high school kids being swallowed alive by city schools where they'd all learned to walk like Barbara, suffering for their small-town accents and inadequate toughness. It was easy to be tough enough in Grace. Well, at least they'd know how to use condoms. I could give them that to carry through life. I settled the glass lid back over the terrarium and turned out the lights. I would be long gone before the ruination of Grace. I had a 1-year contract. Now I'd made sure of it. Rita Cardinal called me up on the phone. She hesitated for a second before speaking. "I don't think your old man has all his tires on the road." "It's possible." I sat down in my living room chair and waited for her to go on. "Did you tell him about me? About dropping out?" "Rita, no. I wouldn't do that." Silence. She didn't believe me. To Rita, we were both authority figures, but at least she'd called. "My father and I aren't real close," I said. "I go up to see him every week, but we don't exactly talk." A pregnant teen could surely buy that. "Well, then he's got a slightly major problem." "What did he do?" "He just sort of went imbalanced. I went in for my 5-month checkup, and he said the babies were too little, but he was all kind of normal and everything." She paused, "and then all of a sudden he just loses it and gets all creeped and makes this major scenario, yelling at me." "What did he say?" "Stuff, like that I had to eat better and he was going to make sure I did. He said he wasn't going to let me go out of the house till I shaped up. It was like he just totally went mental. He was using that tape measure thing to measure my stomach, and then he just puts it down, and there's tears in his eyes, and he puts his hands on my shoulders and kind of pulls me against his chest. He goes, 'We have to talk about this. Do you have any idea what's inside of you?'" I got creeped out. I felt dizzy. There was a long pause. "Miss? Cody?" "Rita, I'm really sorry. What can I tell you? He's losing his mind. He's got a disease that makes him confused. I think he was really just trying to do his job, but he got mixed up about what was the appropriate way to talk to you. I heard that. That he had that disease where you go cuckoo and turn back into a baby. Well, that's not quite the way I'd put it, but it's true. Occasionally rumors are true. Is it true you're really a doctor? I looked out my east window at the wall of red rock that rose steeply behind the house. No, I said, that isn't true. Did he tell you that? No, she paused. Well, yeah, he said something a real long time ago, that you were in medical school or something, but not this last time. I heard it from somebody else, that you're a doctor and Doc Homer's dying and you're going to take over. Take over? Take over being the doctor for Grace. They said you already saved that baby down at Doña Altea's restaurant. Oh, Jesus Christ. Look, people say stuff, okay? Rita said. This town is full of major mouths. It's just what I heard. I'm only here till the end of the school year. So you can tell whoever's spreading that gossip, they're full of shit. Okay, sorry. I regretted snapping at Rita. It's okay, I said. It's not your fault. I'm not used to living in a place where everybody's into everybody else's business. It's the bottom level, isn't it? My mom found out I was pregnant from a lady that works at the bank. Mom goes, what is the date today? And the lady goes, the 14th. Your daughter will be due around Valentine's Day, won't she? I had a baby on Valentine's Day. Rita paused for my opinion. Yeah, I said, it's the bottom level. Uh-huh. Mom told me after that she had to tear up 3 checks in a row before she could make one outright. Like that was my fault. I set out to find Doc Homer the minute I hung up the phone, but it took me a long time to track him down, and my energy for drama kind of petered out. First, I went to his office in the basement of the old hospital up on the plateau. It was 4 o'clock on a Wednesday, and he should have been there. But Mrs. Quintana said he'd gone downtown to check on old Mr. Moreno's oxygen machine because it was making a noise, and then he was going to stop at the grocery to pick up some pork chops. It had been 30 minutes, so I figured I'd catch him if I skipped Mr. Moreno and went straight to the grocery. But I got there too late. The grocer, Mrs. Campbell, said he had come there first, having forgotten he needed to go to Mr. Moreno's. He'd stood for 6 or 8 minutes in canned goods, as if lost, and then it came to him. Mrs. Campbell told me this with a sort of indulgent wink, as if he were Einstein or something and you could forgive it. He'd left for the Moreno's house, but first he was going next door to the pharmacy to pick up Mr. Moreno's emphysema medication. I skipped the pharmacy and headed for the bright pink Moreno house, thinking I'd catch him as he came out, and we could walk together back up the long hill past the hospital to his house. So the war on germs and Grace was being waged by a man who got lost in fruit cocktail. There was a clinic in Morse, just across the state line, and according to Mrs. Quintana, a lot of people now drove over there. Disloyally, she had implied. She adored my father. She noted primly that they'd have problems with their state insurance forms. On my way to the Moreno's, I stopped at the P.O. There was a letter from Hallie, which I would save for later. I liked reading them alone, with time for filling in whatever she might leave out. It turned out the Moreno visit had been unexpectedly brief, and he'd left already. The oxygen machine had stopped making noises all on its own. I walked back up the hill alone. By the time I finally did get to Doc Homer's kitchen, his pork chops were cooked and he was just sitting down. He looked surprised, almost pleased, his face turning up from the table, and he offered to put something on the stove for me, but I told him I wasn't hungry. I sat down at my old place at the table where I'd passively refused food 1,000 times before. But tonight it made me sad to watch him eat his solitary supper. He'd cooked 1 serving of an entire balanced meal, vegetables and everything. This amazed me. When Carlo went on his work binges at the hospital, I skipped meals notoriously. I was lucky if I hit all the food groups in 4 consecutive days. But I supposed Doc Homer had gotten the knack of solitude. For him, it wasn't a waiting period. It was life. "I hear you were kind of hard on Rita Cardinal," I said. He flushed slightly. "Do you know her? She's expecting twins. She needs to take better care of herself." "I know. She was one of my students till day before yesterday. She's a good kid." "I'm sure she is," he said, "but she is rather hard to talk to. I wrote down a prescribed diet for her, which she wadded up and threw in the waste paper basket before she left my office. She said she would eat what she pleased, since her life was already a totally creeped scenario. That is a quote." I smiled. Kids here have their own minds, I'm finding out. I hadn't really expected that. They do. My students talk like a cross between Huck Finn and a television set. He seemed slightly amused. I knew I was avoiding the issue. I took a deep breath. "I think I've let things go too long. I should have talked to you a long time before now. I don't think you're doing too well, and I feel like I should be taking care of you, but I don't know how. We're the blind leading the blind here. All I know is it's up to me to do it." "There is no problem, Cody. I'm taking an acridine derivative, tacrine. It keeps the decline of mental functions in check." "Tacrine slows the decline of mental functions, if you're lucky. And it's experimental. I'm not stupid. I did a lot of reading in the medical library after you told me about this." "No, you are not stupid, and I am fine."
"You always say you're fine."
"Because I always am." "Look, I'm only here till next summer. We need to get things squared away. What are you going to do when you can't keep up your practice anymore? Do you think you're being fair?" He got up his cauliflower, running the knife between the tines of his fork. He dissected it into neat, identical-sized cubes and did not answer me until he was completely finished. "I'll do what I've always planned to do. I'll retire." "You're 66, I said. "When do you plan to retire?" "When I can no longer work carefully and capably."
"And who's going to be the judge of that?"
"I am."
I stared at him.
"Well, I think there's some evidence you're slipping in the careful and capable department." My heart was beating hard. I'd never even come close to saying something like that to him. I didn't wait for an answer. I got up and walked into the living room. It was the same, piles of junk everywhere. I was startled by something new, a dozen women's shoes from somewhere arranged in a neat circle, toes pointed in. Superficial order imposed on chaos. It's exactly how I would have expected Doc Homer to lose his marbles. I felt dizzy and unsupported by my legs or Doc Homer's floor, and I sat down. I couldn't even tell Hallie this. She would come home. The old red and black wool afghan, Hallie's and my comfort blanket in old times, was still folded tidily on the sofa. In the months I'd been here, it hadn't been unfolded once, I was sure. I took the thick bundle of it into my arms and walked back into the kitchen and sat down, this time in Hallie's chair, the afghan pressed against my chest like a shield. "I'm taking this, if you don't mind. I'll need it when it gets cooler."
"That's fine," he said.
I stared at him for another minute.
"Do you know what people in Grace are saying?"
"That the moon is made of green cheese, I imagine." He got up and began to wash the dishes from his small meal. A large and a small skillet, a vegetable steamer, a saucepan, plate and glass, spoons and knives of various sizes, and the Piper forceps. Including the pot lids, around 20 separate utensils to cook and consume maybe 8 ounces of food. I felt obsessive myself for counting it all up, but it seemed to be a symbol of something. The way he'd lived his life, doing everything in the manner he thought proper, whether it made sense or not. "They're saying I'm a doctor," I said to his back. "That I've come here to save Grace."
Hallie and I had already used up all the possible jokes on our town and Doc Comer. Saving grace. Amazing grace. Everyone left a bitter taste in the mouth. And how do they propose that you're going to do that? I don't know. However, doctors usually perform their miracles. You know very well what doctors do. You finished 4 years of medical school and you nearly finished your internship. You were only 2 or 3 months away from being licensed to practice. I touched my fingertip to some vagrant breadcrumbs scattered across the table. Because his back was turned, I had the courage to ask the question point blank. How severely do you hold that against me, that I didn't make doctor? Who is saying you didn't make it? I'm saying it right now. I don't have it in me, now or ever. Just the idea of me being a doctor is ridiculous. People depending on me in a life or death situation? Remember when I took Red Cross swimming lessons? I tried out the elbow hold rescue on Ginny Galvez and we had a near-death experience. He spoke without turning around. How did you arrive at the conclusion that you could not be a doctor? For a minute, I buried my face in the afghan, which smelled like a familiar animal. When I looked up again, he was facing me, drying his hands on a dish towel, one finger at a time. I would just like to know, he said. I couldn't make it through my rotation on OBGYN. I was delivering a premature baby, which turned out also to be breech, and there was fetal distress, and the mother's pressure started to shoot up. I just walked away from it. I don't even remember exactly what I did, but I know I left her there. She could have died. I corrected myself. They both could have died. You were only a first-year resident, and it was a high-risk delivery. I'm sure there was someone on hand to back you up, malpractice laws being what they are. That's not the point. You don't have to deliver babies to be a physician. I no longer deliver babies myself. There are 100 specialties you could choose that have nothing to do with obstetrics. That isn't the point. People were looking to me for a decision, and I lost my nerve. You can't lose your nerve. You're the one that taught me that. He looked me straight in the eye and said, I lose my nerve 12 times a day. It was the last thing on earth I expected to hear. I felt as if I'd been robbed. I put my face back in the afghan, and suddenly I started to cry. I have no idea where the tears came from. They just came from my eyes. I didn't want either one of us to admit helplessness here. I kept my face down for a long time, soaking the wool. When I finally glanced up, he was putting something away in the refrigerator. In the dark kitchen, the brightly lit interior of the refrigerator was a whole bright little foreign land of cheerful white boxes, stacked like condominiums. There must have been 50 Tupperware containers in there, pies, cakes, casseroles. I thought of Yuta's squash pie and understood with surprise that all the women of grace were taking care of Doc Comer. As a caretaker, I was superfluous. He saw me looking at him. He stood with the refrigerator door half open, illuminating his face. Cody, you could be a doctor if you wanted to do that. You learned the skills. Don't try to put the blame on something abstract like your nerve. You have to take responsibility. Is it something you want or not? I don't know. He didn't move. I kept thinking he ought to close the refrigerator door. He'd always had a million rules about everything, wasting electricity, for example. It's not, I finally said, for the first time. No? No. I thought it would be an impressive thing to do, but I don't think it was a plan that really grew out of my life. I can't remember ever thinking it would be all that delightful to look down people's throats and into their nasty infected ears and their gallbladders. You're entitled to that opinion, he said.
That the human body is a temple of nastiness?
I held him steady in the eye and he smiled ever so slightly.
You bet, I said. People are a totally creeped scenario.
The news from Hallie was brief and moderately alarming. There had been contra activity in her district. Nobody hurt, but 4 John Deere tractors burnt down to scorched metal hulls. She sounded sick about that. A deer is like a hunk of gold here, she wrote. Because of the U.S. embargo, we can't get parts, and the ones still running are Nicaragua's patron saints. She sounded completely, happily settled in, though, much more so than I was in Grace. She talked about waking up in the mornings, roosters hopping up onto the windowsill, an army of little girls in polyester dresses out in the street with huge baskets on their heads, forging out on 100 urgent missions. She was making good progress with some new cultivation methods. Wished she knew more about diesel mechanics. A man named Julio, a literacy teacher from Matagalpa, had asked her out on a date. She drew stars all around the word date, making fun of herself. They had busy schedules, so finally they met after work and rode together to a meeting in a church where Hallie delivered a lecture on pesticide safety. The church was full of gnats and kerosene smoke and little kids crawling around on a big piece of plastic, crying, impatient for their parents to take them home to bed. She and Julio had ridden over together on her horse, Sopa del Dia, and had a nice time going home. Sunday night was Halloween, and Emelina's children took to the streets. Grace was at an interesting sociological moment. The teenagers inhaled MTV and all wanted to look like convicted felons, but at the same time, nobody here was worried yet about razor blades in apples. Emelina volunteered me to go trick-or-treating with the 4 older boys while she stayed home to dispense bribes to the rest of the town's marauders. She felt a pagan holiday would do me good. I was only chaperone and crossing guard, not expected to go in costume. There was a state law against anyone over 12 wearing a mask or making direct requests at people's doors. The city fathers of Grace were independent to an extent. They ignored state law when they closed school on November 2nd for the town's biggest holiday, the Day of All Souls. But to be on the safe side, they were going along with the Halloween mask law. John Tucker was disappointed, but tried not to show it. Emelina encouraged him to go with us anyway, more or less as a second chaperone. She was wonderful to watch. I guess I'd never really seen good mothering up close. He agreed to go, dressed in JT's black raincoat with a 1/4 inch of talcum powder on his face. Emelina ran deep eyeliner shadows under his eyes. It was convincing. He looked either sick or dead, depending on his position. Mason went as a bug, with grocery bag wings and radio antennae strapped to his head with a yellow sweatband. He instructed Emelina to draw on bug fangs with her eyebrow pencil. I don't think Emelina ever actually wore makeup. She just kept it on hand for emergencies. The twins both were going as teenagers, which is to say, convicted felons, but decided they needed fangs also. We made a pretty good haul. In this fruit basket of a valley, I'd never seen such an orgy of sucrose. Jawbreakers and gummy bears multiplied in the kids' bags like the loaves and fishes. The twins pulled me along by both hands, and Mason gripped my leg when we crossed the street. We hit every house on the road that circled the canyon to the south, the longest possible route to the courthouse. John Tucker hung back in the shadows at the edges of yards, but I escorted the boys right up to the doorsteps, secretly enjoying these little peeks into people's bright living rooms. Our last stop was at the lemon-yellow home of Mrs. Nunez, whom I knew to be an important figure in the Stitch and Bitch Club. I was beginning to learn my way around the matriarchy of Grace, a force unknown to me in childhood. Old Mrs. Nunez recognized the kids immediately, but for some reason mistook me for Emelina. I think she just didn't really look. She chattered at the boys as she dropped Hershey's Kisses and bubblegum into their heavy grocery bags. "Oh, what an awful-looking bug you are. You get away from my house, you old cucaracha. And you ugly old twins, too. You're too scary." She kissed them all on the tops of their heads. She stopped suddenly, holding her glasses and peering out at the pale apparition of John Tucker, who was hanging back around her shrubs as required by law. "Cielo santo," she said with real concern. "What's the matter with your brother?"
"He's 13," said Glenn.
All Souls' Day dawned cool, and the people of Grace put on their sweatshirts and gave thanks. The heat wave was broken. By 8:30, the sun was well up and sweatshirts peeled off again, but it was still a perfect day. Every able-bodied person in Grace climbed the canyon roads to converge on the cemetery. It was the bittersweet Mexican holiday, the Day of the Dead, Democratic follow-up to the Catholic celebration of All Hallows. Some people had business with the saints on November 1st and so went to Mass, but on November 2nd, everybody had business at the graveyard. The families traipsing slowly uphill resembled harvester ants, carrying every imaginable species of real and artificial flower, bulging grocery sacks of chrysanthemums and gladioli, tulips made from blue and pink styrofoam egg cartons, long-stemmed silk roses bouncing in children's hands like magic wands, and unclassifiable creations out of fabric and colored paper and even the plastic rings from six-packs. The Stitch and Bitch Club had had 4 special meetings in a row. When Hallie and I were very small, we used to be allowed to participate in this celebration with JT's family. I wondered if Viola remembered having us in tow. In my own mind, it was all vague. What I remembered best was the marigolds, cempasúchiles, the flowers of the dead. I asked Viola about them. "They come on the truck," she answered cryptically. "Do you remember when Hallie and I used to come up here with you?"
"Sure I do. You always ran all over the graves and messed up everything."
Viola didn't pull her punches.
"Well, we were little," I said defensively. "Doc Homer made us quit coming after a while. I remember that. I remember him saying, 'Those great-grandmothers aren't any of your business.'"
"Well, he was the boss."
"Right, he was the boss."
Emelina and the 4 older boys were marching ahead, but I was pushing the stroller over gravel, and Viola was over 60, so we both had an excuse to lag. We were a harvester ant clan ourselves, burdened not only with flowers, but with food and beer and soft drinks and sundry paraphernalia. John Tucker was carrying a new, largish St. Joseph for Viola's husband's grave. JT was still in El Paso, and Lloyd was on a switch engine in Yuma, but we didn't seem to need them all that much. It looked like a female holiday, what with the egg carton flowers. A festival of women and children and old people and dead ancestors. Viola stopped for breath, holding the bosom of her shiny black dress and looking down at the canyon. I waited with her, adjusting the red handkerchief Emelina had tied over Nicholas's bald head to shield it from sun. As he vibrated over the corduroy road, the kerchief kept slipping down over his eyes, and he looked like a drunken pirate. I bent over and looked into his face, upside down. He enlightened me with a wicked pirate smile. It was a spectacular day. The roadside was lined with bright yellow plumes of rabbit brush, apparently too common a flower for anyone to take to a grave, but I liked them. I would try to remember to pick some on my way back down, to stick in the clay ollas around my house. I was determined to prove to Emelina that I wasn't completely bereft of domestic instincts. From where we stood, we could look down on the whole of Grace, plus the many small settlements that lay a little apart from the town, strung out along the length of Gracela Canyon and its tributaries, often inhabited by just a few families, some with their own tiny graveyards. These settlements were mostly abandoned now. A lot of them had been torn right up when Black Mountain chased a vein of copper under their floors. Others had been buried. The company had an old habit of digging and dumping where it pleased. Grace's huge main cemetery was located on the opposite side of the canyon, as far as possible from the mine, for exactly that reason. Not even the graveyards were sacred. At the upstream end of the canyon, we could also see the beginnings of the dam that would divert the river out toward Tortoise Canyon. There had been a ridiculous photo in the local paper. The company president and a couple of managers at a groundbreaking ceremony, wearing ties, stepping delicately on shovels with their wingtip shoes. These men had driven down from Phoenix for the morning and would drive right back. They all had broad salesman smiles. They pretended the dam was some kind of community improvement project, but from where Viola and I stood, it looked like exactly what it was, a huge grave. Marigold orange earth movers hunched guiltily on one corner of the scarred plot of ground. "So what's going to happen?" I asked Viola. "The Lord in heaven knows," she said. I prodded. "Well, there was a meeting last night. Have you talked to anybody?" "Oh, sure. The men on the council had another one of their big meetings about it and decided to have a lawsuit. A lawyer came up from Tucson to meet with Jimmy Soltovedas." Jimmy was the mayor. The town council had nothing to do with Black Mountain anymore. Grace wasn't a company town in the classical sense, except for the fact that the company owned everything we walked on. "What did the lawyer say?" In a moment of vanity, I wondered if anyone had mentioned my affidavit. My line about the approximate pH of battery acid seemed like something a lawyer could gleefully quote. "The lawyer said we might have grandfather rights to the water, and so we could have a class action lawsuit to make the company give us back our river." "How long will that take?" She shrugged. "Maybe 10 years.
10 years?
"Right. In 10 years, we can all come back and water our dead trees." "Did anybody go to the newspapers to get some publicity about this? It's ridiculous."
"Jimmy called the newspapers half a dozen times. I talked to Jimmy's wife. Nobody's interested in a dipshit little town like Grace. They could drop an atom bomb down on us here, and it wouldn't make no news in the city. Unless it stirred up the weather over there and rained out a ball game or something."
"So it's a 10-year lawsuit?" I didn't want to believe she was right, though her sources were always irreproachable.
"Is that the only thing those guys can come up with against the mountain?"
"Don't call that company the mountain," she said curtly. "It makes it sound like something natural you can't ever move."
"I've heard the men call it that," I said.
Viola snorted like an old horse and started up the hill.
When we arrived, half a dozen elderly men were putting a fresh coat of white paint on the wrought iron fence around the huge cemetery. Wrought iron was a theme here. There were iron crosses and wreaths, and over some of the graves, there were actual little iron houses with roofs. Through the ups and downs of Black Mountain's smelting plant, Grace had been home to a lot of out-of-work metal workers. Most families divided their time between the maternal and paternal lines, spending mornings on one set of graves and afternoons on the other. Emelina and the boys staked out the Domingos plot and set to work sweeping and straightening. One of the graves, a great-uncle of JT's named Vigilancio Domingos, was completely bordered with ancient-looking tequila bottles, buried nose down. Mason and I spent half the morning gathering up the strays and resetting them all in the dirt, as straight as teeth. It was a remarkable aesthetic. I don't mean just Uncle Vigilancio, but the whole. Some graves had shrines with niches peopled by saints. Some looked like botanical gardens of paper and silk. Others had the initials of loved ones spelled out on the mound in white stones. The unifying principle was that the simplest thing was done with the greatest care. It was a comfort to see this attention lavished on the dead. In these families, you would never stop being loved.
The Marigold truck arrived at 10 o'clock. Women swarmed down on it like bees, coming away with armloads of floral gold. There were many theories on the best way to put them to use, or to make them go farthest. Viola, who directed the Domingos family operations, was of the deconstructionist school. She had the boys tear the flowers up and lay the petals down over a grave, blanketing it like a monochrome mosaic. John Tucker stayed at his work, but the twins wandered, and Mason disappeared altogether. Emelina wasn't worried. "He's refining his begging skills he learned on Halloween," she said, and was probably right. Grandmothers everywhere, who at lunch had set out extra plates for the dead, were now indiscriminately passing out the sweet remains of their picnics. By mid-afternoon, Emelina felt we should send out a search party. "Before he eats so many cookies, he busts," she said. Viola volunteered, and I went with her, more or less as a tourist. I wanted to see what else there was in the line of beautified graves. We skirted Gonzalez and Castigliano and Jones, each family with its own style. Some were devotees of color or form, while others went for bulk. One grave, a boy who died young, was decorated with the better part of a Chevrolet. There were hundreds of holes drilled into the fishtail fenders to hold flowers. It was beautiful, like a float in a parade. The cemetery covered acres. To the west of us were collections of small, neglected mounds whose stones bore the names of families that had died out. "Truby," I read aloud, wandering toward the desert of the forgotten. "Alice, Anna, Marcus, Lomas, Hector, Esperanza, Jose, Angel, Carmela." "Honey, we better get back to where people are," Viola cautioned, but I wandered on, as distracted in my way as Mason must have been wherever he was. "Nolina," I shouted. "Look, here's my long-lost relatives." Viola looked at me oddly from her distance across the graves. "I'm kidding," I said. We came from Illinois, as Viola very well knew. "Here's my Aunt Raquel, my Aunt Something Maria." Most of the graves were illegible or so crudely marked there was nothing to read. Then I found one that stopped me dead. "Viola, here's an Omero Nolina." "So it is," she said, not really looking. "Son of a gun." I eyed her. "Do you know something about this?"
"What do you want me to tell you?"
"Who were the Nolinas?"
"Come on back away from there and I'll tell you."
I stood my ground.
"Honey, come on, let's leave these dead folks alone. Nobody put any plates of food out for them for a long, long time. They're not feeling so happy today."
"Okay, but you have to tell me." She told me the Nolinas used to live up around Tortoise River in the northern end of Gracela Canyon. There was a little settlement there that dispersed when the area was covered by mine tailings. The Nolinas had dug up what they could of the family graveyard and carried the bones a few miles to bury them up here. It wasn't all that long ago, she said, around 1950. "I don't know any Nolinas in Grace now," I said.
"No, they're about gone. They never did settle too good into Grace. The most of them went to Texas or somewhere after their houses got tore up. They weren't..."
She stopped and took off her shoe, cocking her stockinged foot against her plump ankle while she examined the inside of it, then put it back on.
"The Nolinas weren't real accepted. They were kind of different all the way back. There was one of the Gracela sisters had auburn hair and a bad temper, and she married Conrado Nolina. They say that family went downhill."
"They were trash, is what you're telling me."
"No, just different."
I followed behind her as she plodded along, dodging headstones. She was as intransigent in her way as Doc Homer.
"So," I asked her, "how come one of them has practically the same name as my father?"
"You better ask him that," she said. "It's his name." At that moment, something hit me from behind like a torpedo, tackling me around the knees. It was Mason.
"Where have you been, Pachuco? Your mama was worried to death about you," Viola said.
Mason had an enormous sucker ballooning under one cheek. He laughed, recognizing Viola's scoldings as a bald-faced lie.
"I was at a birthday party," he lied back.
It took a while to coax him back to the fold. There were an infinity of distractions. Calaveras, little skull-shaped candies for children to crack between their teeth. The promise of a chicken leg for a kiss. Little girls and boys played makeup, standing on tiptoe with their eyes closed and their arms at their sides, fingers splayed in anticipation, while a grown-up used a marigold as a powder puff, patting cheeks and eyelids with gold pollen. Golden children ran wild over a field of dead great-grandmothers and great-grandfathers, and the bones must have wanted to rise up and knock together and rattle with joy. I have never seen a town that gave so much of what counts, to its children. More than anything else, I wish I belonged to one of these living, celebrated families, lush as plants, with bones in the ground for roots. I wanted pollen on my cheeks and one of those calcium ancestors to decorate as my own. Before we left at sunset, I borrowed a marigold from Emelina's great aunt Pocha, who wouldn't miss it. I ran back to lay it on Omero Nolina, just in case. Omero. Chapter 15. Mistakes. He has to look at her for a long time before he trusts himself to speak. Who is this girl? His daughter Cody, but which Cody? He thinks. You look surprised.
You startled me. I wasn't expecting anyone.
He was doing Mr. Garrison's lab work, waiting for the centrifuge to spin down Mr. Garrison's blood cells, and when he looked up, she was standing in the doorway. He detests surprises.
Pop, I called 5 minutes ago to see if you were here. I told you I was coming. I came straight here.
I spent the day up at the graveyard.
She is leaning against the doorsill holding a bouquet of rabbit brush and roadside weeds, showering the air with pollen like an old feather duster. She has on purple cowboy boots, which even now are damaging her arches.
And now you are here, he says carefully.
I found a surprise in the graveyard, a headstone, with a name on it you might recognize.
Yours, almost yours.
Perhaps I am dead.
She stares. Do we have relatives from here?
Yuda Dell gave those to her, to both girls, for Christmas. The boots and straw cowboy hats and holsters with cap guns so that they could run like banshees around the house pretending to fill each other with imaginary bullet holes.
He took the guns away for the preservation of their souls and the boots on account of their arches. He let them keep the hats. The minute hand on the wall clock jumps and the centrifuge slows to a stop, clicking suggestively. Like the wheel of fortune. Without its mechanical whine, the lab is very quiet. He looks up again, and she is still there in her stocking feet and red straw cowboy hat, its dark cord knotted under her chin. She understands about the guns, but she wants the boots back. She has come on behalf of herself and her sister, she says. Her left foot in its white sock curls under. Why is it that only girls stand on the sides of their feet? As if they're afraid to plant themselves. Tears stream from her eyes. He can't relinquish either the guns or the boots. He wishes he could do all these things differently, but he can't. He says, I don't think we need to discuss this any further.
Oh, come on, just tell me. Would it kill you to tell me?
Startled. He looks again. She isn't in stocking feet. She has boots on. She is much too tall. He is confused and becomes angry. He has a glass vial of blood in his hands. This is his office. She didn't need to sneak down here and startle him in his own doorway. I'm doing Mr. Garrison's hematocrit, he says. I have a good bit more work to do.
She sighs loudly. She must be 14. In a year, she will be sullen and furtively pregnant. Or has that passed too? He doesn't even look at her because there is too much there, and he's afraid. She is his first child, his favorite. Every mistake he ever made.
Cosima. Chapter 16. Bleeding Hearts. At the first sign of winter, the trees began to die. Leaves and aborted fruits fell in thick, brittle handfuls like the hair of a cancer patient. The abundance of sun and warmth, which we thought would never end, had led the trees on too, promising the impossible. But now the daylight grew thin and they showed no will to live. A dead sea of leaves drifted deep and undisturbed on the orchard floors. No children played there. I spent a lot of time considering the mystery of my family tree. I didn't push the subject of the Nolinas, but I did ask people about my mother, whose leavings were scant. I'd grown up with only one sentence repeated like a mantra. It wasn't childbirth she died of. It was organ failure. I know this was meant to protect Hallie and me from guilt, but organ failure, in its way, was equally unhelpful, a pronouncement that reminded me of those doubtfully groomed children in school whose report cards bore failing marks through every season, perennial as grass. Organ failure sounded like something our mother ought to be ashamed of, and us after her, for her in death. Viola dispensed with the organ failure myth as easily as snapping a wishbone. No, it was childbirth, she told me. But Hallie was born in June, I said. She didn't die till later in the summer. It was a few weeks, Viola conceded. Hallie gave her a real good round. She lost a lot of blood, and after the birth, she never got up again. I was stunned by this news, and we walked in silence for a while. We were on our way to a special meeting of the Stitch and Bitch Club. To my surprise, I'd been invited as a guest scientist to talk about the pH of the river. Needlework was not on the agenda. Viola had on a brown cloth coat and what must have been her dead husband's hunting cap, ear flaps down, the whole thing cocked forward to accommodate her thick coiled bun. She stopped to pick up two stray peacock feathers, which she tucked into her coat pocket. One was perfect, with an iridescent blue eye bobbing at its tip. The other one had no eye. "What did she look like?" I asked. "Like you. Exactly like you, only smaller. She had real little hands and feet." I looked down at my size nines defensively. "Not like Hallie?" "Hallie always favored Doc Moore," Viola said. I pondered this but couldn't see it. Hallie was so vital, and Doc Homer looked drawn. But then what I saw really was their interiors, not their facades. Your own family resemblances are a frustrating code, most easily read by those who know you least. "Well, I know she was pretty," I said. "Everybody says that. With a name like Alice, how could you not be pretty?" Viola made an odd sound, like unconsummated laughter. "What?" "He was the only one that ever called her Alice. Everybody else called her Althea. It means the truth." "Althea? What? She was an honorary member of the Doña Althea family?" Viola said nothing. I never knew what to make of her dark hints. But this one was wildly improbable. My impression was that she'd stayed an outsider like the rest of us. Doc Homer had married my mother and come out here from Illinois after World War II, after he'd served in the army and finished his internship. Her maiden name was something like Carlisle. We never pressed him for more. When it came to our mother, Doc Homer seemed to be in an extended mourning period that lasted for our whole lives to date. It made me curious, though. I had visions of trying again, of pinning his fragile shoulder blades against the wall of his basement office and forcing him to tell the whole truth about our family, as if Doc Homer's tongue could be forced. Abruptly, Viola and I reached the American Legion Hall. We walked into a noisy room bright with artificial light, and I felt disoriented as to the decade. Women wearing cable-knit cardigans over thin house dresses crowded the hall with their talk, their large purses, and their imposing bosoms. When they saw Viola and me, they began to come to some kind of order. Chairs were dragged, with much metallic howling, from conversational circles back into crooked rows. Many faces were familiar to me now from some encounter, such as old Mrs. Nunez, who'd been so chatty when I took the boys to her house trick-or-treating, and others like Yuda Dell I knew specifically. Doña Altea presided from an overstuffed chair at the front of the hall, but did not speak. Her face was as finely lined as the grain in maple wood, and about the same color. Her pale blue eyes blazed in the direction of the air over our heads. You could have taken her for a blind woman if you didn't know the truth, which was that Doña Altea's vision was sharp as a hawk's. Norma Galvez, whose shellacked white hair was crowned with a navy bow that coordinated with her steelworker's T-shirt, brought the meeting to order. It was a packed house. It took a while to achieve perfect quiet. Viola ushered me to a chair at the front table, hurried over to say hello to Doña Altea, and deposited the two feathers in a grocery bag of kindred feathers at the Doña's feet. Then she scurried back and took her seat by me. "Viola brought a guest," announced Mrs. Galvez, accompanied by vigorous nodding from Viola. She'd removed her hunter's cap. "You all know Doc Homer's daughter, Cosima. She's going to tell us about the contamination." That was my introduction. I was expecting to hear all about myself and the situation, as is always done at meetings that go on too long. But she was through, and I was on. I stood a little shakily, thinking of Hallie, who felt at home giving lectures in a church full of mosquitoes and kerosene smoke and squalling babies. "I'm not an expert," I began. "Here's the chemistry of it. Black Mountain Mining has been running sulfuric acid, which is a clear, corrosive, water-miscible acid, through their tailing piles to recover extra copper. It combines to make copper sulfate, which is also known as blue vitriol. People used to use it to kill rats and pond algae and about everything else you can name. There's a ton of it in your river. And there's straight sulfuric acid in there, too. The EPA finally sent a report saying that kind of pollution is very dangerous, and they can't put it near people and orchards, so Black Mountain is building a dam to run the river out Tortoise Canyon. You know that part of the story, and the men on the town council are pushing for a lawsuit that will get some action in the 21st century. There was some snickering. I remembered my talk with Viola on the hill overlooking the dam construction site, her disgust. The Stitch and Bitch Club wasn't banking on the good old boys. "I really don't know any way of helping out with your problem," I said. "All I can tell you is that you have a problem, and why, which I guess is what scientists are mainly good for." I paused to swallow. The room was a silent garden of blinking faces, expecting something from me. "My students and I looked at the river water under microscopes, and the usual things that live in a river aren't there. Then we tested the pH of the river and found out it's very acidic. The EPA has tested it too, and they agree. But your trees knew all this way before we did. Watering them from the river is just like acid rain falling on them, if you've heard of that. The acid rain problem here in the West comes mostly from mine smelters. It's the same acid, one way or the other, sulfuric acid." I feared I was losing my grasp of the subject, but they were still listening. "I don't think I can tell you anything helpful, but Viola said I should come anyway. If you have questions, I'll try to answer them." I sat down. A thin woman in cat's eye glasses and a red dress stood up and demanded, "You mean the fish and stuff is all killed?
My husband claims they was catching crappies out there a month or two ago.
Well, I said, no, the fish.
Stand up, honey. We can't hear you, said Miss Lorraine Colder, my fourth grade teacher. She and Miss Elva Dan, who sat next to her, had lived together forever and resembled each other, although they were no relation. Not the fish, I said. They're still alive, but the smaller things that live in the water. I considered how to phrase this and started again. Usually there's a whole world of microscopic things living in a river and in the dirt and in the air. If you were in an airplane and flew over a city and looked down and saw nothing was moving, you'd know something was up. That's how you can tell if a river is healthy or not. You can't see them, but they're supposed to be there. The woman in the red dress hugged her sweater around her. Like bugs? Kind of, I said. Another woman said in Spanish that if the river water killed bugs, she'd better take some and sprinkle it around her son's house. There was a good bit of laughter. It won't kill cockroaches, I said. Too bad. You could sell it for a fundraiser. They laughed again, though there were some surprised looks, and I was secretly satisfied. All my life here, people had spoken Spanish around me the way grown-ups spell around children. The woman in the red dress was still standing. What we want to know is the river poison for good? Would we be better off to let them run it out Tortoise Canyon? Every person in the room was looking at me. It dawned on me that they weren't conceiving of their situation as hopeless. What they wanted was not sympathy or advice, but information. Well, no, I said. The river could recover. It doesn't start here. It starts up on the Apache Reservation, in the mountains where the snow melts. As long as that's pure, the water coming down here will be okay. So, if you could stop Black Mountain from running the acid through the tailing piles, then after a while the junk would get washed out? Inquired Mrs. Galvez. Like flushing the John? Exactly like that, I said. 50 women started talking at once. You'd think I'd commuted a death sentence. After a minute, Doña Altea carefully pushed herself up from the arms of her chair and stood, waiting for quiet. In her black dress, she rustled like an old crow. She gave a short speech in Spanish, the gist of which was that I'd told them what they needed to know, and now they had to figure out how to get the company to stop building the dam and stop polluting the river and go to hell. I sat down, a bit stunned. My Spanish was passably good, thanks to the years of Hallie's refugees sleeping on my couch. But some of Doña Altea's more idiomatic swear words were new ones on me. Also, she referred to me as la huérfana, the orphan. They always called Hallie and me that. It seemed unkind. My husband used to be a crane operator when the mine was running, shouted a woman in the back row. He would know how to fix up them bulldozers from hell to breakfast. My husband was a dynamite man, volunteered another woman. That would be quicker. Excuse me, but your husbands won't put Chinese arithmetic past no bulldozers, said Viola. Mrs. Crane Operator and Mrs. Dynamite seemed unperturbed, but Viola added thoughtfully, No offense. Mine would be just as lazy, except he's dead. Mrs. Galvez nodded. Well, that's the truth. My husband says the same thing. The lawyers will fix it up, honey. If the men were any use, they'd be here tonight instead of home watching the football game. What are you talking about, football? Asked Mrs. Dynamite. Muchacha, didn't you hear the Miss America pageant is on tonight? She stood up. Whose husbands was watching the Broncos game when you walked out of the house? There was a show of hands. Okay, 10 seconds, and, she leaned forward, dropped her jaw, and bugged her eyes wide like a pair of fried eggs. If you got remote control, 3 seconds. Sure, why do you think they all hurried us out of the house tonight? A woman added from the front row. Why, yes, honey, go on to your club. I'll be okay. I'll just eat me a TV dinner here and watch football. Like hell. Football in a bathing suit. Okay, girls, said Mrs. Galvez, adjusting her hair and wrapping the table with her high-heeled pump. Like Doña Altea says, we got some darn good thinking to do tonight.
I say we were on the right track with the dynamite, said Viola. There was general nodding. The woman in the red dress stood again. We don't know how to use the dynamite, though. And the men, they might be good men, but they wouldn't do it. They'd be scared to, I think, or they don't see no need. These men don't see how we got to